would understand the Iliad, and it is worth understanding. We have to accept those values for those characters. Must we accept the novel that is full of racial hatred, that vilifies persons of African or Asian or Jewish ancestry? Of course not. Is The Merchant of Venice anti-Semitic? Probably. More or less so than its historical moment? Much less, I should think. Shylock, while hardly a glowing picture of the Jew, is at least given reasons for being as he is invested with a kind of humanity that many nonfiction tracts of the Elizabethan period do not credit Jews with having. Shakespeare does not blame him for the crucifixion, nor does he recommend burning Jews at the stake, as was happening in the century of the play's composition in other parts of Europe. So accept the play or reject it. Do as you see fit. What I would suggest is that we see Shylock's villainy in the context of the difficult and complex situation Shakespeare creates for him. See if he makes sense as an individual, and not merely as a type or representative of a hated group. See if the play works independently of whatever bigotry might lie behind it, or if it requires that bigotry to function as art. For me, if it must rely on hatred in order to function, it has to go. I don't see Merchant working only or even primarily as a product of bigotry, and I will go on reading it, although there are many works by Shakespeare that I like better and return to more regularly. Each reader or viewer must decide this one for himself. The one thing I find unacceptable is to reject it or any work sight unseen. Let's take briefly a more recent and more troubling example. The Cantos of Ezra Pound have some marvelous passages, but they also contain some very ugly views of Jewish culture and Jewish people. More to the point, they are the product of a man who was capable of being much more anti-Semitic than he is in the poems, as he proved in his wartime broadcasts on Italian radio. I sort of weaseled my way around the issue with Shakespeare, claiming that he was somewhat less bigoted than his time. I can make no such claim for Pound. Moreover, that he made such statements at precisely the time that millions of Jews were being put to death by the Nazis only compounds our sense of outrage toward him. Nor can we write it off as insanity, which is what the defense counsel did at his trial for treason. He was charged with broadcasting for the enemy. So what about the poetry? Well, you decide. I know Jewish readers who still read Pound and claim to gain something from the experience, others who refuse to have anything to do with him, and still others who read him but rant against him all the while. Nor does one have to be Jewish. I do still read Pound, some. I find much that is astonishing, beautiful, haunting, powerful. Very much worthwhile. I also find with some regularity myself asking, how could someone so talented be so blind, so arrogant, so bigoted? The answer is, I don't know. The more time I spend with him, the more I'm astonished by his capacity for folly. It's unfortunate that genius was harnessed to someone who may not have worn it well. I find the Cantos, for all its brilliance, a very flawed masterpiece, flawed for reasons other than the anti-Semitism, but certainly more flawed because of it. It remains one of the half dozen or so most important works in my field of specialization, however, so I can't turn my back on it even if I want to. I've been telling you earlier in this chapter that you generally want to adopt the worldview the work requests of its audience. Sometimes, though, as in the case of Pound and his Cantos, the work asks too much. Now here is where I envy you. If you are a professor, you have to deal with some pretty unsavory characters and some questionable works. If you only want to read like one, you can walk away whenever you want to. Chapter 26. Is He Serious? And Other Ironies. Now hear this. Irony trumps everything. Consider roads. Journey, quest, self-knowledge. But what if the road doesn't lead anywhere, or rather, if the traveler chooses not to take the road? We know that roads, and oceans and rivers and paths, exist in literature only so that someone can travel. Chaucer says so, as do John Bunyan, Mark Twain, Herman Melville, Robert Frost, Jack Kerouac, Tom Robbins, Easy Rider, Thelma and Louise. If you show us a thoroughfare, you better put your hero on it. But then there's Samuel Beckett. Known as the poet of stasis, he puts one of his heroes literally in an ash can. The great actress Billy Whitelaw, who was in virtually every Beckett play that called for a woman, said his work repeatedly put her in the hospital, sometimes by demanding too much strenuous activity, but just as often by not letting her move at all. In his masterpiece, Waiting for Godot, he creates two tramps, Vladimir and Estragon, and plants them beside a road they never take. Every day they return to the same spot, hoping the unseen Godot will show up, but he never does. They never take the road, and the road never brings anything interesting their way. In some places, writing something like that will get you a 15-yard penalty for improper use of a symbol. Of course, we catch on pretty fast, and soon understand that the road exists for Didi and Gogo to take, and that their inability to do so indicates a colossal failure to engage life. Without our ingrained expectations about roads, however, none of this works. Our hapless duo become nothing more than two guys stranded in desolate country. But they're not merely in desolate country, but in desolate country beside an avenue of escape they fail to take. And that makes all the difference. Irony? Yes, on a variety of levels. First, the entire play exists in what the late literary theorist Northrop Frye calls the ironic mode. That is, we watch characters who possess a lower degree of autonomy, self-determination, or free will than ourselves. Whereas normally in literary works we watch characters who are our equals or even superiors, in an ironic work, we watch characters struggle futilely with forces we might be able to overcome. Second, the specific situation of the road offers another level of irony. Here are two men, Didi and Gogo, who wish to find possibilities for change or improvement, yet they can only understand the road they wait beside passively, in terms of what it brings to them. We in the audience can see the implication that eludes them. This is where our expectations concerning roads enter the equation, so much so that we may want to scream at them to walk up the road to a new life. But of course they never do. Or take Rain. Of course, we already know that it has nearly limitless cultural associations, but even those won't cover the literary possibilities once irony kicks in. If you read a scene in which new life was coming into being, the rain outside would almost inevitably lead you, based on your previous reading, to a process of association in which you thought or felt, since this really works as much at the visceral as at the intellectual level, rain, life, birth, promise, restoration, fertility, continuity. What, you don't always run that cycle when rain and new life are on the table? If you begin to read like an English professor, you will. But then there's Hemingway. At the end of A Farewell to Arms, his hero, Frederick Henry, having just experienced the death of his lover, Catherine Barclay, and her baby during childbirth, distraught, walks out into the rain. None of those expectations we just listed are going to prevail. In fact, quite the opposite. It might help to know Hemingway's background in World War I, during which the novel is set, or his earlier life experiences, or his psychology and worldview, or the difficulty of writing this passage. He wrote the last page 26 times, he said, in order to make sense of this scene. Most of all, we need to know that it's ironic. Like most of his generation, Hemingway learned irony early, then met it firsthand in the war as he watched youth meet death on a daily basis. His book is ironic from its first words, literally. His title is taken from a 16th century poem by George Peele, A Farewell, about soldiers rallying enthusiastically to the call to war, the first two words of which are, "To arms!" By conjoining these two in one seamless phrase, Hemingway makes a title as nearly opposite Peele's rousing meaning as it's possible to get. That ironic stance pervades the novel right up to the end, where mother and child, rather than existing for each other, as experience has taught us to expect, slay each other, the infant strangled by the umbilical cord, the mother dead after a series of hemorrhages. Frederick Henry walks out into rain in a season that is still winter, but comes on the heels of a false spring. There's nothing cleansing or rejuvenating about the whole thing. That's irony. Take our expectations and upend them. Make them work against us. You can pretty much do this with anything. Spring comes and the wasteland doesn't even notice. Your heroine is murdered at dinner with the villain during a toast in her honor, no less. The Christ figure causes the destruction of others while he survives very nicely. Your character crashes his car into a billboard but is unhurt because his seatbelt functions as designed. Then, before he can get it off, the billboard teeters, topples, and crushes him. Its message? Seatbelts save lives. Is the billboard the same as those other instances of irony? Sure, why not? It's a sign that's used in a way other than the intended one. So are the others. What is a sign? It's something that signifies a message. The thing that's doing the signifying, call it the signifier, that's stable. The message, on the other hand, the thing being signified, and we'll call that the signified, that's up for grabs. The signifier, in other words, while being fairly stable itself, doesn't have to be used in the planned way. Its meaning can be deflected from the expected meaning. Here's an instance. G.K. Chesterton, a mystery writer and contemporary of Arthur Conan Doyle, has a story, The Arrow of Heaven, 1926, in which a man is killed by an arrow. Of the cause of death, there is never a flicker of doubt. That's too bad, since it sets up an insoluble problem. No one could have shot him but God. The victim is in a high tower with higher windows, so there is no way for a straight shot except from heaven. Father Brown, Chesterton's little hero slash detective slash priest, studies the matter a while, listening to all the stories, including one intended to misdirect him, about how those Indian swamis could throw a knife from an impossible distance and kill a man. So maybe they worked their magic in this case with an arrow. This story immediately reveals the solution. No divine bow, but a murderer in the room with the victim. If a knife, which is intended for close use, can be thrown, then an arrow can be used to stab. Everyone except Father Brown makes the error of assuming that the arrow can only mean one thing. Our expectations about the arrow, like those of the characters in the story, point us in one direction. But Chesterton deflects the meaning away from those expectations. Mysteries, like irony, make great use of deflection. The arrow itself is stable. Arrows are arrows. The uses to which arrows can be put, and the meanings we attach to them, however, are not so stable. Well, the seatbelt billboard is an arrow. So are the deadly dinner, the failed Christ figure, Hemingway's rain, and Beckett's road. In each case, the sign carries with it a customary meaning, but that doesn't guarantee it will deliver that received meaning. The signifier is stable. The rain is neither ironic nor not ironic. It's simply rain. That simple rain, however, is placed in a context where its conventional associations are upended. The signified's meaning stands opposed to what we expect. Since one half of the sign is stable and the other is not, the sign itself becomes unstable. It may mean many things. But what it won't mean is the thing we came in expecting that it would. Still, that expected meaning keeps hanging around, and since we experience this phantom meaning as an echo at the same time as the newly created dominant meaning, all sorts of reverberations can be set off. It's kind of like the way jazz improvisation works. Jazz musicians don't just launch into random sound. Rather, the combo begins by laying out a melody, which is the basis for everything that will follow. Then, when the trumpeter or the pianist cuts loose, running through the chorus 2, 3, 15 times, each one a little different, We hear each of those improvisations, those changes, against our memory of the original melody. That memory is largely what makes the experience of the solo meaningful. This is where he started, and now this is where he's taken us. What irony chiefly involves, then, is a deflection from expectation. When Oscar Wilde has one character in The Importance of Being Earnest, 1895, say of another, recently widowed, that her hair has gone quite gold from grief, the statement works because our expectation is that stress turns people's hair white. Someone becoming blonde in widowhood suggests something else entirely, that perhaps her grief has not been so all-consuming as the pronouncement suggests on the surface. Wilde is the master of comic irony in both verbal and dramatic forms, and he succeeds because he pays attention to expectations. Verbal irony forms the basis for what we mean when we say irony. In ancient Greek comedy, there was a character called an iron, who seemed subservient, ignorant, weak, and he played off a pompous, arrogant, clueless figure called the Alazon. Northrop Frye describes the Alazon as the character who doesn't know that he doesn't know, and that's just about perfect. What happens, as you can tell, is that the iron spends most of his time verbally ridiculing, humiliating, undercutting, and generally getting the best of the Alazon, who doesn't get it. But we do. Irony works because the audience understands something that eludes one or more of the characters. By the time we get to Wilde, we can have verbal irony that needs no Alazon, but that uses an assumed innocence as the basis against which it plays. The irony with which we're dealing in this discussion, though, is chiefly structural and dramatic, rather than verbal. We know what should happen when we see a journey start, or when the novel cycles through the seasons and ends in spring, or when characters dine together. When what should happen doesn't, then we have Chesterton's Arrow. E.M. Forster only wrote a handful of books early in the 20th century, but two of them, A Passage to India and Howard's End, 1910, are among the truly great novels. The latter deals with a class system and issues of individual worth. One of its important characters is a working-class man, Leonard Bast, who is determined to improve himself. He reads books approved for the purpose, such as John Ruskin on art and culture. He goes to lectures and concerts, always struggling to better himself. His efforts do lead him to meet people of the higher classes, the bourgeois Schlegel sisters, and through them, the aristocratic Wilcox family. We might expect this pattern to hold true and to lead him up and out of his wretched existence. Instead, he ends up finding greater wretchedness and death where he had hoped for his soul's ascent. Henry Wilcox advises him, through Helen Schlegel, to leave his banking position for a more secure firm, but the advice proves to be completely wrong, as his old bank continues to prosper while his new post is eliminated. Moreover, in his despair, he has spent a night with Helen that has left her pregnant, and when Charles Wilcox attempts to exact retribution, Leonard dies of a heart attack. Irony, right? But there's more. We would normally see his love of books as something that is affirming of values, improving and educational, all of which we know as positive virtues. As Leonard collapses, however, the last thing he sees are the books from the bookcase he has pulled over on himself. We sense the disjunction between what books ought to be and the function assigned to them here by Forster. It goes on and on. In Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, her damaged Great War veteran Septimus Warren Smith commits suicide because his enemies are coming to get him. His enemies? Two doctors. We customarily associate physicians with healing, but in this novel, they are interfering and threatening figures. Characters in Iris Murdoch's Unicorn spend a great deal of time trying to identify one of their number as the title creature, which is associated in folk mythology with Christ. Yet their first choice, who also seems to be the princess held captive in the tower, turns out to be selfish, manipulative, and murderous, while the second candidate winds up drowning another character, named Peter, no less. Hardly the image of Christ one would expect in either case. In each of these novels, the dislocation between our expectations and the reality constitutes a dual awareness, a kind of double hearing that is the hallmark of irony. That dual awareness can be tricky to achieve at times. I can bring a discussion of A Clockwork Orange to silence by suggesting that we consider Alex, its protagonist, as a Christ figure. Alex? The rapist and murderer Alex? No doubt Anthony Burgess's protagonist has some high negatives. He is supremely violent, arrogant, elitist, and worst of all, unrepentant. Moreover, his message is not one of love and universal brotherhood. If he's a Christ figure at all, it's not in any conventional sense. But let's consider a few facts. He leads a small band of followers, one of whom betrays him. He is succeeded by a man named Pete, although this fact is troubling since this Pete, unlike Peter, is also the betrayer. He is offered a bargain by the devil. He relinquishes his soul in the form of spiritual autonomy in exchange for the freedom awarded for undergoing aversion therapy. He wanders in the wilderness after his release from prison, then launches himself from a great height, one of the temptations Christ resists. He seems to be dead, but then revivifies. Finally, the story of his life carries a profound religious message. None of these attributes looks right. They look instead like parodies of Christ's attributes, or rather, none of the attributes but that last one. This is a very tricky business. No, Alex is not like Jesus. Nor is Burgess using Alex to denigrate or mock Jesus. It can look that way, however, if we approach the matter from the wrong angle or consider it carelessly. It's a help, of course, to know that Burgess himself held deep Christian convictions, that issues of goodness and spiritual healing occupy a major place in his thought and work. More important, though, is the item I place at the end of my list, that the purpose of telling Alex's story is to convey a message of religious and spiritual profundity. The book is really Burgess's entry in the very old debate over the problem of evil, namely, why would a benevolent deity permit evil to exist in his creation? His argument runs like this: there is no goodness without free will. Without the ability to freely choose or reject the good, an individual possesses no control over his own soul, and without that control, there is no possibility of attaining grace. In the language of Christianity, a believer cannot be saved unless the choice to follow Christ is freely made, unless the option not to follow him genuinely exists. Compelled belief is no belief at all. The Gospels offer us a positive model for their argument. Jesus is the embodiment of the behaviors Christian believers should embrace, as well as the spiritual goal toward which they strive. A Clockwork Orange, on the other hand, provides a negative model. In other words, Burgess reminds us that for goodness to mean anything, not only must evil exist, but so must the option of choosing evil. Alex freely and joyously chooses evil, although in the final chapter he has begun to outgrow that choice. When his capacity to choose is taken away, evil is replaced not with goodness, but with a hollow simulacrum of goodness. Because he still wants to choose evil, he is in no way reformed. In acquiring the desired behavior through the Ludovico technique, as the aversion therapy is called in the novel, society has not only failed to correct Alex, but has committed a far worse crime against him by taking away his free will, which, for Burgess, is the hallmark of the human being. In this regard, and only in this one, is Alex a modern version of Christ. Those other aspects are a bit of ironic window dressing the author embeds in his text as cues for how to understand Alex's story and the message he unwittingly conveys. Nearly all writers employ irony sometimes, although the frequency of occurrence varies greatly. With some writers, particularly modern and postmodern writers, irony is a full-time business, so that as we read them more and more, we come to expect that they will inevitably thwart conventional expectations. Franz Kafka, Samuel Beckett, James Joyce, Vladimir Nabokov, Angela Carter, and T. Corrigeson Boyle are only a few of those 20th century masters of the ironic stance. If we were wise, we would never open a Boyle novel or short story expecting him to do the conventional thing. Some readers find relentless irony difficult to warm to, and some writers find that being ironic carries perils. Salman Rushdie's irony in the Satanic Verses did not register with certain Muslim clerics. So there's our second ironic precept. Irony doesn't work for everyone. Because of the multivocal nature of irony, we hear those multiple voices simultaneously, readers who are inclined toward univocal utterances simply may not register that multiplicity. For those who do, though, there are great compensations. Irony, sometimes comic, sometimes tragic, sometimes wry or perplexing, provides additional richness to the literary dish. And it certainly keeps us readers on our toes, inviting us, compelling us to dig through layers of possible meaning and competing signification. We must remember, irony trumps everything. In other words, every chapter in this book goes out the window when irony comes in the door. How do you know if it's irony? Listen. Chapter 27. A Test Case. The Garden Party by Catherine Mansfield. And after all, the weather was ideal. They could not have had a more perfect day for a garden party if they had ordered it. Windless, warm, the sky without a cloud. Only the blue was veiled with a haze of light gold, as it is sometimes in early summer. The gardener had been up since dawn, mowing the lawns and sweeping them, until the grass and the dark flat rosettes where the daisy plants had been seemed to shine. As for the roses, you could not help feeling they understood that roses are the only flowers that impress people at garden parties, the only flowers that everybody is certain of knowing. Hundreds, yes, literally hundreds, had come out in a single night. The green bushes bowed down as though they had been visited by archangels. Breakfast was not yet over before the men came to put up the marquee.
"Where do you want the marquee put, Mother?"
"My dear child, it's no use asking me. I'm determined to leave everything to you children this year. Forget I am your mother. Treat me as an honored guest."
But Meg could not possibly go and supervise the men. She had washed her hair before breakfast, and she sat drinking her coffee in a green turban with a dark wet curl stamped on each cheek. Joe's, the butterfly, always came down in a silk petticoat and a kimono jacket.
"You'll have to go, Laura. You're the artistic one."
Away Laura flew, still holding her piece of bread and butter. It's so delicious to have an excuse for eating out of doors, and besides, she loved having to arrange things. She always felt she could do it so much better than anybody else. Four men in their shirt sleeves stood grouped together on the garden path. They carried staves covered with rolls of canvas, and they had big tool bags slung on their backs. They looked impressive. Laura wished now that she had not got the bread and butter, but there was nowhere to put it, and she couldn't possibly throw it away. She blushed and tried to look severe and even a little bit short-sighted as she came up to them.
"Good morning," she said,
copying her mother's voice. But that sounded so fearfully affected that she was ashamed and stammered like a little girl.
Have you come? Is it about the marquee?"
"That's right, miss,"
said the tallest of the men, a lanky, freckled fellow, and he shifted his tool bag, knocked back his straw hat, and smiled down at her.
"That's about it."
His smile was so easy, so friendly, that Laura recovered. What nice eyes he had. Small, but such a dark blue. And now she looked at the others. They were smiling too.
"Cheer up, we won't bite,"
their smile seemed to say. How very nice workmen were. And what a beautiful morning. She mustn't mention the morning. She must be businesslike. The marquee.
"Well, what about the lily lawn? Would that do?" And she pointed to the lily lawn with the hand that didn't hold the bread and butter. They turned, they stared in the direction. A little fat chap thrust out his upper lip, and the tall fellow frowned.
I don't fancy it, said he. Not conspicuous enough. You see, with a thing like a marquee,
and he turned to Laura in his easy way,
you want to put it somewhere where it'll give you a bang slap in the eye if you follow me.
Laura's upbringing made her wonder for a moment whether it was quite respectful of a workman to talk to her of bang slap in the eye, but she did quite follow him.
A corner of the tennis court, she suggested, but the band's going to be in one corner.
Going to have a band, are you?
Said another of the workmen. He was pale. He had a haggard look as his dark eyes scanned the tennis court. What was he thinking?
Only a very small band, said Laura gently.
Perhaps he wouldn't mind so much if the band was quite small. But the tall fellow interrupted.
Look here, miss, that's the place. Against those trees, over there, that'll do fine.
Against the karakas. Then the karaka trees would be hidden, and they were so lovely, with their broad gleaming leaves and their clusters of yellow fruit. They were like trees you imagined growing on a desert island, proud, solitary, lifting their leaves and fruits to the sun in a kind of silent splendor. Must they be hidden by a marquee?
They must. Already the men had shouldered their staves and were making for the place.
Only the tall fellow was left. He bent down, pinched a sprig of lavender, put his thumb and forefinger to his nose and snuffed up the smell. When Laura saw that gesture, she forgot all about the karakas in her wonder at him caring for things like that, caring for the smell of lavender. How many men that she knew would have done such a thing? Oh, how extraordinarily nice workmen were, she thought. Why couldn't she have workmen for her friends rather than the silly boy she danced with and who came to Sunday night supper? She would get on much better with men like these. It's all the fault, she decided as the tall fellow drew something on the back of an envelope, something that was to be looped up or left to hang, of these absurd class distinctions. Well, for her part, she didn't feel them. Not a bit, not an atom. And now there came the chock-chock of wooden hammers. Someone whistled, someone sang out,
Are you right there, matey? Matey!
The friendliness of it, just to prove how happy she was, just to show the tall fellow how at home she felt and how she despised stupid conventions, Laura took a big bite of her bread and butter as she stared at the little drawing. She felt just like a work girl.
Laura! Laura, where are you? Telephone, Laura!
A voice cried from the house.
Coming!
Away she skimmed, over the lawn, up the path, up the steps, across the veranda, and into the porch. In the hall, her father and Laurie were brushing their hats, ready to go to the office.
I say, Laura, said Laurie very fast, you might just give a squiz at my coat before this afternoon, see if it wants pressing.
I will, said she.
Suddenly, she couldn't stop herself. She ran at Laurie and gave him a small, quick squeeze.
Oh, I do love parties, don't you?
Gasped Laura.
Rather,
said Laurie's warm, boyish voice. And he squeezed his sister, too, and gave her a gentle push.
Dash off to the telephone, old girl.
The telephone.
Yes, yes, oh yes. Kitty?
Good morning, dear.
Come to lunch, do, dear. Delighted, of course. It will only be a very scratch meal. Just the sandwich crusts and broken meringue shells and what's left over. Yes, isn't it a perfect morning? You're white. Oh, I certainly should. One moment, hold the line, Mother's calling.
And Laura sat back.
What, Mother? Can't hear.
Mrs. Sheridan's voice floated down the stairs.
Tell her to wear that sweet hat she had on last Sunday.
Mother says you're to wear that sweet hat you had on last Sunday.
Good. 1 o'clock. Bye-bye.
Laura put back the receiver, flung her arms over her head, took a deep breath, stretched, and let them fall. Huh, she sighed. And the moment after the sigh, she sat up quickly. She was still, listening. All the doors in the house seemed to be open. The house was alive with soft, quick steps and running voices,
The green baize door that led to the kitchen regions swung open and shut with a muffled thud. And now there came a long, chuckling, absurd sound. It was the heavy piano being moved on its stiff casters. But the air, if you stopped to notice, was the air always like this? Little faint winds were playing chase, in at the tops of the windows, out at the doors, and there were two tiny spots of sun, one on the inkpot, one on a silver photograph frame, playing, too. Darling little spots, especially the one on the inkpot lid. It was quite warm, a warm little silver star. She could have kissed it. The front doorbell pealed, and there sounded the rustle of Sadie's print skirt on the stairs. A man's voice murmured. Sadie answered careless,
"I'm sure I don't know. Wait, I'll ask Mrs. Sheridan."
"What is it, Sadie?"
Laura came into the hall.
"It's the florist, Miss Laura."
It was indeed. There, just inside the door, stood a wide, shallow tray full of pots of pink lilies. No other kind. Nothing but lilies. Canna lilies, big pink flowers, wide open, radiant, almost frighteningly alive on bright crimson stems.
"Oh, Sadie,"
said Laura, and the sound was like a little moan. She crouched down as if to warm herself at that blaze of lilies. She felt they were in her fingers, on her lips, growing in her breast.
"It's some mistake," she said faintly. "Nobody ever ordered so many. Sadie, go and find Mother."
But at that moment, Mrs. Sheridan joined them.
"It's quite right," she said calmly.
"Yes, I ordered them. Aren't they lovely?"
She pressed Laura's arm.
"I was passing the shop yesterday, and I saw them in the window, and I suddenly thought, for once in my life, I shall have enough canna lilies. The garden party will be a good excuse."
"But I thought you said you didn't mean to interfere," said Laura.
Sadie had gone. The florist's man was still outside at his van. She put her arm round her mother's neck and gently, very gently, she bit her mother's ear.
"My darling child, you wouldn't like a logical mother, would you? Don't do that. Here's the man."
He carried more lilies still, another whole tray.
"Bank them up, just inside the door, on both sides of the porch, please," said Mrs. Sheridan. "Don't you agree, Laura?"
"Oh, I do, Mother."
In the drawing-room, Meg, Joe's, and good little Hans had at last succeeded in moving the piano.
"Now, if we put this Chesterfield against the wall and move everything out of the room except the chairs, don't you think?"
"Quite. Hans, move these tables into the smoking-room, and bring a sweeper to take these marks off the carpet, and—" "One moment, Hans."
Joe's loved giving orders to the servants, and they loved obeying her. She always made them feel they were taking part in some drama.
"Tell Mother and Miss Laura to come here at once."
"Very good, Miss Joes."
She turned to Meg.
"I want to hear what the piano sounds like, just in case I'm asked to sing this afternoon. Let's try over This Life is Weary. Pom, ta-ta-ta, ti-ta."
The piano burst out so passionately that Joes's face changed. She clasped her hands. She looked mournfully and enigmatically at her mother and Laura as they came in.
"This life is weary, a tear, a sigh, a love that changes. This life is weary, a tear, a sigh, a love that changes, and then goodbye."
But at the word goodbye, and although the piano sounded more desperate than ever, her face broke into a brilliant, dreadfully unsympathetic smile.
"Aren't I in good voice, Mummy?"
she beamed.
"This life is weary. Hope comes to die. A dream awakening."
But now Sadie interrupted them.
"What is it, Sadie?"
"If you please, Mum, cook says, have you got the flags for the sandwiches?"
"The flags for the sandwiches, Sadie?"
echoed Mrs. Sheridan dreamily, and the children knew by her face that she hadn't got them.
"Let me see."
And she said to Sadie firmly,
"Tell cook I'll let her have them in 10 minutes.
Sadie went.
"Now, Laura," said her mother quickly, "come with me into the smoking room. I've got the names somewhere on the back of an envelope. You'll have to write them out for me. Meg, go upstairs this minute and take that wet thing off your head. Joes, run and finish dressing this instant. Do you hear me, children?
or shall I have to tell your father when he comes home tonight? And Jose, pacify cook if you do go into the kitchen, will you? I'm terrified of her this morning.
The envelope was found at last behind the dining room clock, though how it had got there, Mrs. Sheridan could not imagine.
One of you children must have stolen it out of my bag, because I remember vividly, cream, cheese, and lemon curd. Have you done that?
Yes.
Egg and...
Mrs. Sheridan held the envelope away from her.
It looks like mice. It can't be mice, can it?
Olive, pet, said Laura, looking over her shoulder.
Yes, of course, olive. What a horrible combination it sounds, egg and olive.
They were finished at last, and Laura took them off to the kitchen. She found Joe's there pacifying the cook, who did not look at all terrifying.
I have never seen such exquisite sandwiches, said Joe's rapturous voice. How many kinds did you say there were, cook? 15?
15, Miss Joe's.
Well, cook, I congratulate you.
Cook swept up crusts with a long sandwich knife and smiled broadly.
Godmother's has come,
announced Sadie, issuing out of the pantry. She had seen the man pass the window. That meant the cream puffs had come. Godmother's were famous for their cream puffs. Nobody ever thought of making them at home.
Bring them in and put them on the table, my girl, ordered cook.
Sadie brought them in and went back to the door. Of course, Laura and Joe's were far too grown up to really care about such things. All the same, they couldn't help agreeing that the puffs looked very attractive.
Very.
Cook began arranging them, shaking off the extra icing sugar.
Don't they carry one back to all one's parties? Said Laura.
I suppose they do,
said practical Joe's, who never liked to be carried back.
They look beautifully light and feathery, I must say.
Have one each, my dears, said cook in her comfortable voice. Your ma won't know.
Oh, impossible. Fancy cream puffs so soon after breakfast? The very idea made one shudder. All the same, 2 minutes later, Joe's and Laura were licking their fingers with that absorbed inward look that only comes from whipped cream.
Let's go into the garden out by the back way, suggested Laura. I want to see how the men are getting on with the Marquis. They're such awfully nice men.
But the back door was blocked by cook, Sadie, Godber's man, and Hans. Something had happened.
Tuk, tuk, tuk,
clucked cook like an agitated hen. Sadie had her hand clapped to her cheek as though she had a toothache. Hans's face was screwed up in the effort to understand. Only Godber's man seemed to be enjoying himself. It was his story.
What's the matter? What's happened?
There's been a horrible accident, said cook. A man killed.
A man killed? Where? How? When?
But Godber's man wasn't going to have his story snatched from under his very nose.
Know those little cottages just below here, miss?
Know them? Of course she knew them.
Well, there's a young chap living there, name of Scott, a carter. His horse shied at a traction engine, corner of Hawk Street this morning. And he was thrown out on the back of his head. Killed.
Dead?
Laura stared at Godber's man.
Dead when they picked him up, said Godber's man with relish. They were taking the body home as I come up here.
And he said to the cook, he's left a wife and 5 little ones.
Joe's come here.
Laura caught hold of her sister's sleeve and dragged her through the kitchen to the other side of the green baize door. There she paused and leaned against it.
Joe's,
she said, horrified.
However are we going to stop everything?
Stop everything, Laura? Cried Joe's in astonishment. What do you mean?
Stop the garden party, of course.
Why did Joe's pretend? But Joe's was still more amazed.
Stop the garden party? My dear Laura, don't be so absurd. Of course we can't do anything of the kind. Nobody expects us to. Don't be so extravagant.
But we can't possibly have a garden party with a man dead just outside the front gate.
That really was extravagant, for the little cottages were in a lane to themselves at the very bottom of a steep rise that led up to the house. A broad road ran between. True, they were far too near. They were the greatest possible eyesore, and they had no right to be in that neighborhood at all. They were little mean dwellings painted a chocolate brown. In the garden patches, there was nothing but cabbage stalks, sick hens, and tomato cans.
The very smoke coming out of their chimneys was poverty-stricken. Little rags and shreds of smoke, so unlike the great silvery plumes that uncurled from the Sheridan's chimneys. Washerwomen lived in the lane, and sweeps, and a cobbler, and a man whose house front was studded all over with minute bird cages. Children swarmed. When the Sheridans were little, they were forbidden to set foot there because of the revolting language and of what they might catch. But since they were grown up, Laura and Laurie on their prowls sometimes walked through. It was disgusting and sordid. They came out with a shudder. But still, one must go everywhere. One must see everything. So through they went.
"And just think of what the band would sound like to that poor woman," said Laura.
"Oh, Laura," Joes began to be seriously annoyed. "If you're going to stop a band playing every time someone has an accident, you'll lead a very strenuous life.
I'm every bit as sorry about it as you. I feel just as sympathetic."
Her eyes hardened. She looked at her sister just as she used to when they were little and fighting together.
"You won't bring a drunken workman back to life by being sentimental," she said softly.
"Drunk? Who said he was drunk?"
Laura turned furiously on Joe's. She said, just as they had used to say on those occasions,
"I'm going straight up to tell Mother."
"Do, dear," cooed Joe's.
"Mother, can I come into your room?"
Laura turned the big glass doorknob.
"Of course, child. Why, what's the matter? What's given you such a color?"
And Mrs. Sheridan turned round from her dressing table. She was trying on a new hat.
"Mother, a man's been killed," began Laura.
"Not in the garden," interrupted her mother.
"No, no.
Oh, what a fright you gave me." Mrs. Sheridan sighed with relief and took off the big hat and held it on her knees.
"But listen, Mother," said Laura.
Breathless, half-choking, she told the dreadful story.
"Of course, we can't have our party, can we?" she pleaded. "The band and everybody arriving. They'd hear us, Mother. They're nearly neighbors."
To Laura's astonishment, her mother behaved just like Joe's. It was harder to bear because she seemed amused. She refused to take Laura seriously.
"But my dear child, use your common sense. It's only by accident we've heard of it. If someone had died there normally, and I can't understand how they keep alive in those pokey little holes, we should still be having our party, shouldn't we?"
Laura had to say yes to that, but she felt it was all wrong. She sat down on her mother's sofa and pinched the cushion frill.
"Mother, isn't it terribly heartless of us?" she asked.
"Darling." Mrs. Sheridan got up and came over to her, carrying the hat. Before Laura could stop her, she had popped it on.
"My child," said her mother, "the hat is yours. It's made for you. It's much too young for me. I have never seen you look such a picture. Look at yourself."
And she held up her hand mirror.
"But, Mother,"
Laura began again. She couldn't look at herself. She turned aside. This time, Mrs. Sheridan lost patience, just as Joe's had done.
"You are being very absurd, Laura," she said coldly. "People like that don't expect sacrifices from us, and it's not very sympathetic to spoil everybody's enjoyment as you're doing now."
"I don't understand," said Laura, and she walked quickly out of the room into her own bedroom.
There, quite by chance, the first thing she saw was this charming girl in the mirror, in her black hat trimmed with gold daisies and a long black velvet ribbon. Never had she imagined she could look like that.
"Is Mother right?" she thought.
And now she hoped her mother was right.
"Am I being extravagant?" Perhaps it was extravagant.
Just for a moment she had another glimpse of that poor woman and those little children and the body being carried into the house. But it all seemed blurred, unreal, like a picture in the newspaper. "I'll remember it again after the party's over," she decided. And somehow, that seemed quite the best plan. Lunch was over by 1:30. By 2:30, they were all ready for the fray. The green-coated band had arrived and was established in a corner of the tennis court.
"My dear," trilled Kitty Maitland, "aren't they too like frogs for words? You ought to have arranged them round the pond, with the conductor in the middle on a leaf."
Laurie arrived and hailed them on his way to dress. At the sight of him, Laura remembered the accident again. She wanted to tell him. If Laurie agreed with the others, then it was bound to be all right. And she followed him into the hall.
Laurie!
Hello? He was halfway upstairs, but when he turned round and saw Laura, he suddenly puffed out his cheeks and goggled his eyes at her.
My word, Laura, you do look stunning, said Laurie. What an absolutely topping hat.
Laura said faintly, Is it? And smiled up at Laurie and didn't tell him after all. Soon after that, people began coming in streams. The band struck up. The hired waiters ran from the house to the marquee. Wherever you looked, there were couples strolling, bending to the flowers, greeting, moving on over the lawn. They were like bright birds that had alighted in the Sheridan's garden for this one afternoon on their way to... where? Ah, what happiness it is to be with people who all are happy, to press hands, press cheeks, smile into eyes.
Darling Laura, how well you look!
What a becoming hat, child.
Laura, you look quite Spanish. I've never seen you look so striking.
And Laura, glowing, answered softly,
Have you had tea? Won't you have an ice? The passion fruit ice is really a rather special.
She ran to her father and begged him,
Daddy, darling, can't the band have something to drink?
And the perfect afternoon slowly ripened, slowly faded, slowly its petals closed.
Never a more delightful garden party.
The greatest success.
Quite the most.
Laura helped her mother with the goodbyes. They stood side by side in the porch till it was all over.
All over, thank heaven, said Mrs. Sheridan.
Round up the others, Laura. Let's go and have some fresh coffee. I'm exhausted.
Yes, it's been very successful, but oh, these parties. Why will you children insist on giving parties?
And they all of them sat down in the deserted marquee.
Have a sandwich, Daddy dear. I wrote the flag.
Thanks. Mr. Sheridan took a bite and the sandwich was gone. He took another.
I suppose you didn't hear of a beastly accident that happened today, he said.
My dear, said Mrs. Sheridan, holding up her hand, we did. It nearly ruined the party. Laura insisted we should put it off.
Oh, Mother!
Laura didn't want to be teased about it.
It was a horrible affair all the same, said Mr. Sheridan. The chap was married, too. Lived just below in the lane and leaves a wife and half a dozen kiddies, so they say.
An awkward little silence fell. Mrs. Sheridan fidgeted with her cup. Really, it was very tactless of Father. Suddenly she looked up. There on the table were all those sandwiches, cakes, puffs, all uneaten, all going to be wasted. She had one of her brilliant ideas.
I know, she said. Let's make up a basket. Let's send that poor creature some of this perfectly good food. At any rate, it will be the greatest treat for the children, don't you agree? And she's sure to have neighbors calling in and so on. What a point to have it all ready prepared.
Laura, she jumped up. Get me the big basket out of the stairs cupboard.
But, Mother, do you really think it's a good idea? Said Laura.
Again, how curious. She seemed to be different from them all. To take scraps from their party. Would the poor woman really like that?
Of course. What's the matter with you today? An hour or two ago you were insisting on us being sympathetic, and now?
Oh, well. Laura ran for the basket. It was filled. It was heaped by her mother.
Take it yourself, darling, said she. Run down just as you are. No, wait. Take the arum lilies, too. People of that class are so impressed by arum lilies.
The stems will ruin her lace frock, said practical Joes.
So they would, just in time.
Only the basket, then, and Laura!
Her mother followed her out of the marquee.
Don't on any account...
What, Mother?
No, better not put such ideas into the child's head.
Nothing. Run along.
It was just growing dusky as Laura shut their garden gates. A big dog ran by like a shadow. The road gleamed white, and down below in the hollow, the little cottages were in deep shade. How quiet it seemed after the afternoon. Here she was going down the hill to somewhere where a man lay dead, and she couldn't realize it. Why couldn't she? She stopped a minute, and it seemed to her that kisses, voices, tinkling spoons, laughter, the smell of crushed grass were somehow inside her. She had no room for anything else. How strange. She looked up at the pale sky, and all she thought was, yes, it was the most successful party. Now the broad road was crossed. The lane began, smoky and dark. Women in shawls and men's tweed caps hurried by. Men hung over the palings. The children played in the doorways. A low hum came from the mean little cottages. In some of them there was a flicker of light, and a shadow, crab-like, moved across the window. Laura bent her head and hurried on. She wished now she had put on a coat. How her frock shone! And the big hat with the velvet streamer? If only it was another hat! Were the people looking at her? They must be. It was a mistake to have come. She knew all along it was a mistake. Should she go back even now? No, too late. This was the house. It must be. A dark knot of people stood outside. Beside the gate, an old, old woman with a crutch sat in a chair, watching. She had her feet on a newspaper. The voices stopped as Laura drew near. The group parted. It was as though she was expected, as though they had known she was coming here. Laura was terribly nervous. Tossing the velvet ribbon over her shoulder, she said to a woman standing by, "Is this Mrs. Scott's house?" And the woman, smiling queerly, said, "It is, my lass." Oh, to be away from this! She actually said, "Help me, God," as she walked up the tiny path and knocked. To be away from those staring eyes, or to be covered up in anything, one of those women's shawls even. I'll just leave the basket and go, she decided. I shan't even wait for it to be emptied. Then the door opened. A little woman in black showed in the gloom. Laura said, "Are you Mrs. Scott?" But to her horror, the woman answered, "Walk in, please, miss." And she was shut in the passage. "No," said Laura. "I don't want to come in. I only want to leave this basket. Mother sent..." The little woman in the gloomy passage seemed not to have heard her. "Step this way, please, miss," she said in an oily voice, and Laura followed her. She found herself in a wretched little low kitchen, lighted by a smoky lamp. There was a woman sitting before the fire.
"Em," said the little creature who had let her in. "Em, it's a young lady."
She turned to Laura. She said meaningly,
"I'm her sister, miss. You'll excuse her, won't you?"
"Oh, but of course," said Laura. "Please, please don't disturb her. I only wanted to leave."
But at that moment, the woman at the fire turned round. Her face, puffed up, red with swollen eyes and swollen lips, looked terrible. She seemed as though she couldn't understand why Laura was there. What did it mean? Why was this stranger standing in the kitchen with a basket? What was it all about? And the poor face puckered up again.
"All right, my dear," said the other. "I'll thank the young lady."
And again she began,
"You'll excuse her, miss, I'm sure."
And her face, swollen too, tried an oily smile. Laura only wanted to get out, to get away. She was back in the passage. The door opened. She walked straight through into the bedroom, where the dead man was lying.
"You'd like a look at him, wouldn't you?"
said Em's sister, and she brushed past Laura over to the bed.
"Don't be afraid, my lass."
And now her voice sounded fond and sly, and fondly she drew down the sheet.
"He looks a picture. There's nothing to show. Come along, my dear."
Laura came. There lay a young man, fast asleep, sleeping so soundly, so deeply, that he was far, far away from them both. Oh, so remote, so peaceful. He was dreaming. Never wake him up again. His head was sunk in the pillow, his eyes were closed. They were blind under the closed eyelids. He was given up to his dream. What did garden parties and baskets and lace frocks matter to him? He was far from all those things. He was wonderful. Beautiful. While they were laughing and while the band was playing, this marvel had come to the lane. Happy. Happy. "All is well," said that sleeping face. "This is just as it should be. I am content." But all the same, you had to cry. and she couldn't go out of the room without saying something to him. Laura gave a loud, childish sob.
"Forgive my hat," she said.
And this time, she didn't wait for M's sister. She found her way out of the door, down the path, past all those dark people. At the corner of the lane, she met Laurie. He stepped out of the shadow.